The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Good evening. Tonight is indeed a unique occasion in the history of television. We are very privileged and deeply honored to have with us in the studio Karl Marx, founder of modern socialism and author of the Communist Manifesto. Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, better known to the world as Lenin, leader of the Russian Revolution, writer, statesman, and father of modern communism. Che Guevara, the Cuban guerrilla leader, and Mao Zedong, leader of the Chinese Communist Party since 1949. And the first question is for you, Karl Marx. The Hammers. The Hammers is the nickname of what English football team?
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, November 19, 2025. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right wing, it's just right.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Well, there have been increasing alarm bells sounded of late, warning of a rise in socialism's popularity among a majority of American young people. This alarm comes on the heels of the election of Zoran Mamdani as the mayor of New York City, and while it is accurate to say that there has been a rise in socialist politicians getting elected, to attribute these elections to any popularity of socialism is a bit misguided in my humble estimation. And I'll tell you why, right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. Now talk economics all you want, but in every debate between socialism and capitalism, the only thing that matters is to recognize that capitalism is the moral system and socialism is an immoral system. And these are not subjective conclusions. Morality is that which is life-sustaining. Immorality is that which is life-destroying. And capitalism is life-sustaining. Socialism is life-destroying. Back in 1990, following the provincial election of the New Democratic Party in Ontario, Canada, an avowedly socialist party under the leadership of Bob Rae, I penned an essay in the Freedom Party of Ontario's Freedom Flyer entitled Socialism 101. And it began with the question, so what's wrong with socialism? And today, decades later, most people still don't know the answer to that question, and everything I wrote in that essay is still as valid today as it was then. Quote, socialism, as an understandable concept, has little or no relevance to the average voter's daily concerns or daily life. To them, socialism is just some nebulous label that politicians use to belittle one another, even though they may all behave the same and pursue the same socialist policies. End quote. Well, of course, today in New York, socialism is no longer a dirty word, have you heard? But yes, it is. Changing one's moral evaluation of an evil ideology is somewhat akin to trying to change a definition and meaning of a word like the word socialism, and it means that those doing so are lying to us. So what's wrong with socialism? Here's how I briefly answered that question in 1990, and I quote, socialism is the political application of the philosophy of egalitarianism. Socialist equality does not mean equality before the law, which is the capitalist interpretation of equality. It means the precise opposite. It means equality of result. It means that those who work hard, take risks, and produce the goods, services, and products upon which a society's survival depends must be punished to the degree of their success, while those who do not fit into the productive class, for whatever reason, are to be rewarded by sharing in the products they had no part in creating, end quote. Now today we'll be hearing some testimonies and descriptions of socialism that perfectly fit that description. But before we get into that part of the conversation, from his own November 12 podcast, Glenn Beck offered a beautifully concise overview of America's socialist crisis, along with a surprisingly excellent suggestion of how to counter it.
I don't know if you saw the Washington Post editorial over the weekend on New York City's new socialist mayor, Zoran Mandami, here to save the day. It said Zoran Mandami drops the mask. The mayor-elect divides New Yorkers into two groups, the oppressed and the oppressors. Oh, so in other words, Marxism 101. The Post goes on to describe the new era of class warfare that has begun in the financial epicenter of the entire world. Mamdani's mask-dropping victory speech, he said some really revealing things. He stated, and I quote, "We will prove there is no problem too large for government to solve, and no concern too small for it to care about."
Oh,
that's socialism. I mean, you know, all of it, everything from culture to housing to rent to groceries, what you do, where you go, business, all centrally planned. How did this happen? Wars have been fought to end the scourge of this flawed ideology, an ideology that's been responsible for mass starvation, death, and murder all throughout history. Well, the Washington Post highlighted exit polling that showed who actually voted for Mamdani. And it, surprise, surprise, wasn't the New Yorkers that were born in New York City. His base are newcomers to the city, and most of them have very advanced degrees, so they're much, much smarter than you, Lovey. Now, listen to this quote from the Post, because it's amazing. Quote, "Apparently, living in New York for decades and witnessing what does and doesn't work when it comes to running a city offers more wisdom than grad school." Oh. "The youth and recent college educated are now turning to socialism." Great. Listen to this from Mamdani's victory party. Listen.
"Now, socialist is not a dirty word anymore.
What do you say?
Socialist is not a dirty word anymore.
Well, that's why they jumped to communists, right? You got to be a communist.
Yeah, you
socialist. They immediately jumped to communists. Socialist is not a dirty word anymore. Democrats, listen up. Yeah. Take some lessons." Yeah.
Socialism is no longer a dirty word, and Democrats, you better take some lessons. And I love how they immediately jump to communism, that remark. Can you believe they say that we're communists? Yeah, I wonder why. It's not as if Karl Marx stated that socialism is the part of the cycle where communism fully becomes possible. It's not like Marx said socialism means full state control, and then communism happens when the state fades away due to full utopian bliss. And what has historically happened after this? Well, famine, political persecution, mass starvation, death, murder, and the full-on collapse of the entire system. Now, it's not like many of these communist governments have ever used the word socialism in their name. I mean, it's communist, right? Not like communist countries ever existed and said, we're socialist. You know, like, who's ever heard of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam or the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics or the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia or the Czechoslovak Socialist Republic or the Socialist Republic of Romania? I mean, these communist countries, they didn't exist with that. Oh, they did. Wow, that's weird. They were all socialist. Huh. Now, I want to go back to this demographic that voted for Mamdani, the youth and highly educated, because there is societal change happening. They're moving towards socialism, and the Trump administration is and surely should be concerned. Just over the weekend, the president addressed multiple issues aimed directly at this societal shift, and it was a flurry of announcements that included school loan repayment changes. I don't like it. Potential 50-year mortgage plan to help people achieve the American dream or ownership. Don't like it. And $2,000 stimulus checks paid through tariff rebates. Don't like it. School loans, debt, all of this, worrying data on home ownership, prices of goods refusing to go down, all of these things, these are the things that average people are talking about. You might be talking about them in your house, but certainly those under 40 are talking about these. These are the things the government is clearly worried about, and they are also the things that have driven many Americans to now view socialism as a viable option. Because nobody ever defines it. Oh, it's like Sweden. We're way past Sweden. All right, bad news is over. You want the good news? What we're seeing right now is just temporary pain. The Trump administration has been preparing for this. I just got off the phone with the president yesterday, and we spoke about this on the phone. And I'm like, you do know what's going on? He's like, yes, I know what's going on. I'm like, but I mean, like, really going on, because, like, socialism and the people are, like, really struggling. He's like, I got it. He knows we're on the brink of major societal change. Some called it the Great Reset. But a new economic global system is now being built by him, and all of the levers are being pulled to ensure we remain resilient for the change that is coming. And change is coming, one way or another. And we're at the threshold of another industrial revolution. This shouldn't shock you. This is stuff we've been talking about for a very, very long time. Remember the episode I did where I said it's the fourth industrial revolution where, you know, all the change that happened from, you know, fire until today are going to happen in the next 4 or 5 years? Yeah. So profound change is coming. How we navigate this new world depends on the moves that we're making right now. The realities turning young people to socialism are so raw and real. But I first want to give you the reason why we got here in the first place. We're not a capitalist society. We're not a free market society. We haven't been for a very long time. Progressivism has been eating at it for over 100 years, and there's almost none of it left now. And no matter how successful capitalism has been, not only for this country, but the entire world, no matter how many millions it has brought people up and out of poverty, how many millions it has led to the greatest living standards in the history of the world, this is what happens. The central planners, they enter the game. This usually happens after capitalism wins. And the central planners are there and they're like, we can fix this, even make it even better. And then they're defeated. And then decades of prosperity ensues. But like cockroaches, they come crawling back from underneath the fridge. But if you shove enough central planning into capitalism, people eventually get pissed off at capitalism because they're like, that doesn't work. That's capitalism. You and I are like, that's not capitalism. But they begin to blame it for all the problems, and that's what central planners want. So then they turn towards central planning and socialism. The guys are like, we haven't tried this yet. Yes, we have. This is the decades-long wild ride we've been on. What happened with Mamdani in New York is not a quirk. We are in real danger here from the youth turning towards socialism on a larger scale. Joining me now is Justin Haskins. He is the vice president of the Heartland Institute, senior fellow at Our Republic. He's also my co-author of Dark Future and the author of a forthcoming book called The Next Big Crash. So let's get into the new poll. You did a survey of young American voters, 18 to 39 years old, on Mamdani and his policies. What did you find?
Okay, very disturbing stuff is what we found. Essentially, young Americans overwhelmingly support socialism. Over half of them said that they wanted, not that they would vote for a socialist in 2028, but that they wanted a socialist president in 2028. That included, depending on which poll, a quarter to 35% or so of Trump voters. So we're talking about even young conservatives want a socialist, a big chunk of them. Over half of the people we polled said that they have a favorable view of Mamdani. And the really scary thing is that even more people, an even higher percentage, depending on the question, it was 58% to over 60%, had a favorable view of Mamdani's radical socialist policies. So it's not just that they've fallen in love with the image of who he is. They actually agree with the policies. They want a dramatic transformation of society. And at the heart of all of this is perceived unfairness.
Okay, so let me stop you there, because they want the policies. I don't think they understand the policies. They hear the free stuff. They hear, you know, you're going to have a house and you're going to have a job and it's going to be fair. That's what they hear. There's not a lot of noodling going on. And it's because they're offering to them a completely new system. And so somebody comes along and you're not taught in school that this is a very dangerous philosophy. Of course you're going to be for it. I mean, I understand completely why they're for it, because they're not, they just go, that doesn't work. He's saying he can fix it. That's new. I haven't heard that before. Yeah, I want that. That's why they want a socialist. It's not that they're for socialism. They're for what it sounds like socialism is. Would you agree with that?
That's 100% right. Yes. Young people are willing to vote for just about anyone. We found that in the survey as well. We asked people if they were likely to vote for a Republican or a Democrat in the next presidential election. And then we asked them, if you said Democrat, for example, we said, okay, well, if the Republican could solve the housing crisis, would you be willing to vote for the Republican? And 4 in 10 of both the Republicans and Democrats said, yeah, I'd vote for the other party. Yeah, I'd do that. Well, why? Because they want change desperately. And they're not sold on any sort of ideological system. I don't think they know it or understand it or care about it. They don't know the history of socialism. They don't know the history of capitalism. They don't know what has worked and what hasn't worked. They don't know why Sweden, Norway, and Denmark are actually not socialist societies, although they once were, and then they ran away from it. They don't know any of this stuff. And because they don't know, and a lot of them don't even care, they just will vote for the hand grenade in the room, for the sledgehammer to the face. That's what they want. They want radical, dramatic change. And whoever they think is going to give that to them, and right now, Republicans aren't offering that. It's just the socialists offering it. Whoever's willing to give that to them, they're going to go in that direction in droves.
Any ideas on what the president could do?
Yeah.
What would you suggest?
So this is going to be a really hard thing for people to hear. But I think the biggest problem, the thing that people like about Donald Trump, who are on our side ideologically especially, and many people in the middle, is that he's a doer. He wants to do things. He wants to fix problems. He's a problem solver. That's his whole thing. But in this particular case, what we need is a problem explainer. Because we have fundamental issues with this economy, to say the least. You've gone over it throughout this special. We need widespread, dramatic transformation of our entire economy. And the only way to do that is to convince people that we need that, so that there's a groundswell of support and Congress finally takes action. So I think what Trump should do is spend more time not trying to come up with solutions that are really half solutions, that it's the best that he can do in his limited situation, but instead he should focus on telling people how we got here. It was government that made healthcare so expensive. It was government that made the student loan crisis. It came from government. It's the housing crisis is because of government. The wealth inequality comes from money printing. It's from government. They're the ones who created these problems, and we can solve them, but it's going to take work from Congress and from the states. It's going to be a big, big overhaul, and people need to be convinced of that, and right now they just aren't.
Less action and more explaining, and therein lies the heart of what I called a surprisingly excellent suggestion of how to counter socialism. But merely explaining why socialism is a very dangerous philosophy will not lead to its opposite. More important than revealing the evils of socialism, and make no mistake, it is important, but more importantly, capitalism itself requires more explaining in such a way as to make it understandable to a majority of people willing to adopt it as part of their culture. When Ayn Rand published her book, Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, she made a point of explaining that she did not write that book to promote capitalism. She wrote it to simply define what capitalism is and what it is not, and about which we'll hear more a bit later on. But armed with that knowledge, she concluded that everyone would choose capitalism by default. I mean, it would be common sense, a critical fundamental to Western culture. And this is essentially the same strategy that Glenn Beck and his guests suggested when they concluded that what we need is a problem explainer. The only way to fix the economy is to convince people that we need to do that. And they are correct, assuming that enough people would inform themselves about the realities of political ideologies, that very well might be the outcome. but most people haven't got a clue about anything political. As Glenn Beck observed, we're not a capitalist society and haven't been for a long time, and people think that's what we have today. They're not for socialism, but for what socialism sounds like it offers. They're not sold on any ideological system. Socialism is seen as a viable option because no one ever defines it, he said. Well, we already offered one definition of socialism as I described it in my 1990 commentary. So let's ask the question again and take a more traditional route. So what's wrong with socialism? Well, first of all, the meaninglessness of the word itself. The dictionary defines socialism thusly, quote, public collective ownership or control of the basic means of production, distribution, and exchange, with the avowed aim of operating for use rather than for profit, and of assuring to each member of society an equitable share of goods, services, etc., end quote. Now, the average normie, hearing that definition, would not perceive any dangers in socialism and would probably still be wondering, yeah, okay, so what's wrong with socialism? Well, the word itself, socialism, has two components, social and ism. Social is defined in the dictionary as of or pertaining to society or its organization, disposed to hold friendly intercourse with others, sociable, also promoting friendly intercourse, constituted to live in society, social beings. And ism is defined as a distinctive theory, doctrine, or system, usually used disparagingly, end quote. So how can anybody possibly be against being sociable and friendly, right? And then there's capital and ism. Capital is defined as the total amount of money or property owned or used by an individual or corporation, wealth in any form employed in or available for the production of more wealth, end quote. Boy, that's a heartwarming and friendly alternative to all that social alternative stuff, isn't it? The very psychology of the words socialism and capitalism work to the advantage of the former and to the disadvantage of the latter. And that's about as far as most people would even go to investigate either term. But if socialism is actually based on public collective ownership or control, then socialism does not and cannot even exist. There is no such thing as public collective ownership. Ownership of a single piece of property or of an object cannot be exercised by a group or collective. That is a metaphysical impossibility. I mean, say you have 20 people who own a single vehicle. Which of them gets to determine the use of that vehicle, when, and on what grounds? Talk about creating conflicts where none should exist. It's like the fiction of all public ownership. And I've given this example before where, for example, in my city of London, the streets and roads are considered public property, but they are in fact owned and operated by a corporation. When Londoners pay their property taxes, they make their checks payable to the Corporation of the City of London, which you will note is a single entity, as a corporation, and is regarded as a person in law. And if any citizen believes that they actually own any part of so-called public property, then just let them try to sell, exchange, or trade that property on the market. Reality will resolve that fantasy in a hurry. Public ownership doesn't even qualify as a believable fiction. And that is why I called even the very term socialism a meaningless one. It's oxymoronic and contradictory. It belongs in the Marxist language of fool's dictionary, as author Isabel Patterson phrased it. And boy, some fools fell for it on a scale unimaginable to most of us in the West. Coming up next, a chilling account of the reality of socialism as described by Nikos Sotirakopoulos from his October 26 presentation online. He begins his account of a piece of fairly recent history that is beyond horrific, and which, he suggests, perfectly reflects what Ayn Rand warned against in her novel Anthem, which was written in 1937. And for those who may not be familiar with the theme of Anthem, on the cover and introductory pages of the book, it reads as follows, quote, "They existed only to serve the state. They were conceived in controlled palaces of mating. They died in the home of the useless. From cradle to grave, the crowd was one, a great we. In all that was left of humanity, there was only one man who dared to think, seek, and love. He, Equality 7-2521, came close to losing his life for this because his knowledge was regarded as treacherous blasphemy. He had rediscovered the lost and holy word, I. He lived in the dark ages of the future. In a loveless world, he dared to love the woman of his choice. In an age that had lost all trace of science and civilization, he had the courage to seek after knowledge. But these were not the crimes for which he would be killed. He was marked for death because he had committed the unpardonable sin. He had stood forth from the mindless human herd. He was a man alone." End quote. Sounds like a nightmare, doesn't it? Science fiction, social fiction. But most have no idea just how horrific such a social condition actually would be. Because not only was it a reality, it threatens to become one again, as we'll hear right now.
Imagine the world of Anthem coming to life. Imagine the dystopia Ayn Rand envisioned of a society without the concept of I, of a society without the concept of an individual self. And imagine this nightmare actually materializing in a real country with real people. This country existed. This country was the communist Cambodia in the 1970s. When the Khmer Rouge, the Cambodian communists, led by a guy called Pol Pot, when they came close to power, they had a vision that was unique among all other communist regimes. They said, we will reach a higher level of communism with no markets, with no money, with no classes, and we will achieve it in day one. Not in the future, not in stages, as was the norm, for example, with Soviet Union. First we get to socialism, then to communism, none of that. Higher communism, radical egalitarianism from day one. And unfortunately for Cambodia, they were true to their word. When they came to power in 1975, their first measure was to completely evacuate the urban centers, to completely empty the capital. And when I say that the capital was empty, I mean it. Like, imagine, what's this film, I'm Legend, where there's a guy walking in an empty town. That was the capital of Cambodia. And all the inhabitants were moved, were marched on foot to the countryside with nothing but the clothes on their back. And there, they would all become farmers. Now, why evacuate the cities to make everyone a farmer? Well, when you leave a city on foot, walking, you cannot take with you any private property. You cannot take with you any material possession. You cannot even take with you your individual identity. Oh, you're a lawyer, you're an engineer, you're a small shop owner. It doesn't matter anymore, because now you are all farmers. Now you're all equals. Their second measure towards radical egalitarianism was to ban the idea of a personal preference. Ban the idea of a personal choice. In communist Cambodia, everyone was dressed in the same clothes, like Anthem. Everyone was eating in communal tables, like Anthem. And people were living in barracks organized in work battalions, again like Anthem. In communist Cambodia, there was no such thing as a hobby. Books were banned, and all music was banned. Because think about it. If you read a book and you read a different book, this is like a statement of preference, that I value something and this guy values something else. So we could have none of that. And even the most intimate, the most personal of choices, which is sexual and romantic attraction, was also persecuted. In communist Cambodia, you could have some arranged marriages for reproduction purposes, but any unsolicited romantic affair could bring the penalty of death. And the result of this egalitarian onslaught was unique in the history of mankind, unique in its destructiveness. Actually, the regime stayed to power only for a very short period. It lasted only 3 years, 8 months, and 20 days. And yet within these three years, they managed to eliminate close to 2 million people. That's close to 22% of the entire population. And while the communists were engaged in this murderous orgy, they had the motto that they used to throw to their class enemies. And the motto went something like this: to keep you is no gain, to kill you is no loss. To keep you is no gain, to kill you is no loss. And how perfectly does this motto capture the essence of collectivism? That you, the individual, each one of you, you don't matter. Even if you die, who cares? The collective is still there. Cambodia is still there. The proletariat is still there. Such a disdain for the value of the individual life was not unique only in Cambodia. In different degrees, it could be seen in every single communist country, in every single communist movement. Soviet Union, Cuba, Yugoslavia, East Germany, China, you name it. All completely different in terms of cultural background, historical background, geopolitical background, but they all shared one thing. Actually, they shared two things. First, the piles of bodies that these regimes accumulated, and second, that they were all inspired by the ideas of the same man. And this man is Karl Marx. So today we have to ask the question: is there something in the ideas of Marx that make his followers so hostile to the value of the individual life? Is Marxism as an ideology at war with individualism? And when I say individualism, I mean the idea that every human being is an end in himself, that you have a right to live your own life and to pursue your own happiness. There are many, many Marxists and sympathizers who make the claim that not only Marx is not against the value of the individual, but Marxism is the only philosophy which is compatible with individual flourishing. And this claim has two very serious results, if it is accepted. The first result is that it completely leaves Marx off the hook for the rivers of blood of the 20th century. And their second point, which is the most dangerous, is that, and therefore, we need to give Marx another chance. But today we're not going to cut them any slack. We're going back to Marx himself, and we will see. What does Marx actually say about individualism? And therefore, we'll be able to answer the question, is Marx to blame for these rivers of blood, and is Marx at war with the individual? A good point to start is to ask, how does Marx view the abstraction which is a human being? So, for example, for Ayn Rand, human beings are the rational animals, okay? And of course, this had an effect on how she would view her politics, like, if since we are rational animals, we need to have freedom and all that stuff. How does Marx see individuals? Marx views human beings as, first and foremost, social producers. Communal producers, social laborers. Because Marx says, when I see the world, I don't view individuals, I view groups. Actually, Marx is mocking scholars who start their analysis from the individual. He calls them the Robinson Crusoe scholars and Robinson Crusoe economists. Because he says, as it is naive and stupid to think that actually there is such a man in a desert island who uses his mind and his ingenuity and starts from scratch and he creates something, therefore, he says, equally, it is a fiction to believe that there is that this figure of the individual, of the sovereign alone individual who creates. So for Marx, we are social communal beings. And what about the second part, that we are laborers? But work also needs to be free, he says. What does it mean to be free? It means that you don't work out of necessity to put bread on the table. You don't work to survive. You work because you want to express who you are. You work because you want to express your personality. So your individuality can only be expressed through work. Work which is done at the benefit of others. For Marx, if you create a painting, for example, there is no point in creating this painting if there are no other people there to admire it, if there are no other people there to take value out of it. So this is work for Marx. Work is always directed outwards. You work for within a society and for the benefit of that society. This is what it means to be communal laborers. Do you notice anything missing, by the way, in Marx's analysis? Where is the use of our mind in all this? And of course, if you push a Marxist in a corner and ask him, but isn't man a rational animal? They would say, yes, but this is not the main thing. This is not the crucial thing. And Marx goes back in history and he says, throughout history, that's what we see. An individual living within a group, family, tribe, clan, and working within the context of this group. But then something happened in history. Then there's a turning point that Marx sees as the most crucial moment in human history, because it's the point where we stop being these communal workers. And that point, of course, is the Industrial Revolution. That point is the rise of capitalism. What Marx describes as the rise of the civil society, what we would call the market. Now, what is Marx's problem with the market? Well, the problem is that when you go to a market, you are not your true self anymore, Marx would say. Because when you go to the market to work, to sell your labor, or to buy something, who do you do it for? You do it for yourself. And also, you work for someone else, but the sole thing in your mind is how to satisfy your needs. Your needs completely separated and completely alienated from the needs of other people. So Marx notices that there's a new figure, a new historical subject that has arisen. And this historical subject is the individual. For the first time in history, from the 19th century, the protagonist of history is not a group, is not a Sparta or an empire, it's the individual. And Marx doesn't like this a bit.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. And you know, the fact that we actually even give a moment of consideration to the rantings of an individual like Karl Marx is in and of itself evidence of a death cult. Or maybe to be kinder, we could call it a death ideology. What is missing? The use of the mind. Yes, Marxism is mindless. Literally, the individual mind is outrightly rejected by Marx. And this mindlessness is manifested in the fake altruistic mentality of socialists. The entire premise of Marxism is based on such a glaring contradiction that to not see it has to be an act of pure evil and not of self-interest. If I as an individual have to abandon my own self-interest for the interests of others, how is it that they get to have interests and I don't? And how come the so-called others in the collective don't have to abandon their interests to serve my interests? But no, wait, nobody has any self-interest under Marxism, so what interest is really being served by Marxism or by socialism? It's sure not the public interest, that's for sure. A collective is incapable of having interests. And another anti-concept, that is, a concept that does not reflect reality, is the term democratic socialism. Socialism and democracy are incompatible, and do not confuse the condition of democracy with the process of voting. Even the most totalitarian countries still carry out routine voting processes, often denying their citizens a right to vote by forcing them to vote under the threat of a state penalty. But to have a right to do anything always entails having the right to say no. Democratic socialism is an anti-concept. It has best been described humorously as one person, one vote, one time. And under socialism, independent votes are not a thing. You only get to vote for the uniparty. And this brings to mind another dangerous concept used to advance socialism and to destroy capitalism. And that's the idea of a mixed economy. Again, I addressed this concept back in 1990 when I wrote, and I quote, "Being parasitic in nature, socialism is forced to cling to capitalism, recognizing that without the creative and productive energies of capitalism, socialism will have no wealth to redistribute. Consequently, progressive socialists now advocate the mixed economy, a euphemism to justify the parasitic relationship between socialism and capitalism, between totalitarianism and freedom. But most people do not fear socialism simply because they do not know how to recognize it, having lived in the mixed economy of socialism's shadow for many, many years now. Ironically, they've been conditioned to blame all the failings of our social system on the only part of it that still works, the capitalist part, and to credit our still relatively high standard of living on that part of our social system that seeks to destroy our standard of living, socialism." End quote. And of course, in reality, it's exactly the other way around. When Glenn Beck rightly observed that socialism is seen as a viable option because no one ever defines it, he failed to mention the other side of that definition coin, that capitalism is not seen as a viable option because no one ever defines it. Merely saying that capitalism works or that capitalism creates abundance is not in any way a description of or justification for capitalism. It merely addresses the consequences of capitalism and not its cause. Or in other words, why capitalism works and the principles on which it is based. And this is where Ayn Rand parted ways with most conservatives and economists who defended capitalism, arguing that they are doing more harm to any understanding of capitalism than are capitalism's avowed enemies. And this is what she wrote in her Introduction to Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal. And again, I quote, "Politics is based on three other philosophical disciplines, metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics, on a theory of man's nature and of man's relationship to existence. It is only such a base that one can formulate a consistent political theory and achieve it in practice. Objectivists are not conservatives. We are radicals for capitalism. We are fighting for that philosophical base which capitalism did not have and without which it was doomed to perish. I want to stress that our primary interest is not politics or economics as such, but man's nature and man's relationship to existence, and that we advocate capitalism because it is the only system geared to the life of a rational being. In this respect, there is a fundamental difference between our approach and that of capitalism's classical defenders and modern apologists. With very few exceptions, they are responsible, by default, for capitalism's destruction. That default consisted of their inability or unwillingness to fight the battle where it had to be fought, on a moral, philosophical ground. by their silence, by their evasion of the clash between capitalism and altruism, it is capitalism's alleged champions who are responsible for the fact that capitalism's being destroyed without a hearing, without a trial, without any public knowledge of its principles, its nature, its history, or its moral meaning. The method of capitalism's destruction rests on never letting the world discover what it is that is being destroyed, or never allowing it to be identified within the hearing of the young. This book is addressed to the young, in years or in spirit, who are not afraid to know and are not ready to give up. What they have to discover, what all the efforts of capitalism's enemies are frantically aimed at hiding, is the fact that capitalism is not merely the practical, but the only moral system in history, end quote. And while talk about an ironic coincidence, you know when that was written and where? It was written 60 years ago, back in 1966, and it was written in the city of New York. Go figure. Ironic also is that our last three shows concern Canada, culminating with last week's show featuring Mark Vandermass on why Canadians should be trying to escape from Canada. Well, sure enough, we're seeing the same phenomenon in New York City, where its residents are escaping to other areas. What both Canada and New York have in common in this context is socialism. But then you already guessed that, didn't you? On this side of our upcoming bumper, here's Tim Poole from his November 13 Timcast, explaining how New York City is collapsing and why its most productive residents are making their own great escapes. And on the return side, once again from Nikos Soterikopoulos, on how, believe it or not, Ayn Rand and Karl Marx actually were in full agreement about the fundamental nature of capitalism.
The collapse of New York City is already beginning. In a variety of stories, this one from The Telegraph, escape from New York, bankers flee Mamdani for Texas. That's right. Big talk about the Texas Stock Exchange. Delaware, of course, is burning itself down. They went after Elon Musk, and now Coinbase is leaving. This is the result of failed Democrat policies and an opportunity in this country for business competition at the governmental level. So here's the question for all of those of limited cognitive capabilities in New York who voted for Zohran Mamdani. Who are you going to tax? Who are you going to tax? It's an honest question that I expect an answer to, because it's not going to be the millionaires and the billionaires, because they're leaving in huge numbers. What we have in New York is people saying, we're going to elect somebody who's going to take from everybody else to solve my problems for me, so I don't have to. The end result? In response, Wall Street's top earners are turning to an unlikely corner of the country, Texas, more specifically Dallas. For some, Mamdani's new regime means Texas is on course to take New York's crown. I hate socialists. They're dangerous retards who want to steal from me. I work really, really hard all day, every day. And it's tough because when you don't see a light at the end of the tunnel, and when you see often when you have bad periods like recession or depression, morale drops, it's hard to keep going. I have to work really, really hard so that lazy, fat people can be on food benefits. I just don't want to do it. I'm like, if I'm going to work as hard as I can and they're going to take it all from me, I'll just work less. Well, my friends, get ready. There's more. Socialist Katie Wilson wins election for Seattle mayor, defeating Democrat incumbent Bruce Harrell. You're going to love this. I got to play this video for you guys. You're going to love it. It's hilarious.
Access to affordable, healthy food is a basic right. We cannot allow giant grocery chains to stomp all over our communities, close stores at will, and leave behind food deserts.
Close stores at will. We cannot allow these companies to close their stores. What are you going to do? Are you going to literally pass a law saying, like, private grocery stores have to remain open? That's a ridiculous thing to say. But she goes on.
Together we can build a Seattle where fresh food is for everyone, not just for those who can afford it.
Oh, man. We don't live in a Star Trek reality where we have food replicators. Food is a finite resource, though it is particularly abundant. We have obese, homeless people.
Food deserts are not natural. Corporations create them when they abandon our communities.
Here, okay, I want you to imagine. Let me just play this. Ma'am, slavery doesn't exist anymore. So if I have a grocery store in Seattle and you come in and I'm like, I'm going to shut it down, you can't force me to stay. You can't be like, nope, you're not going anywhere. Ain't going to happen.
As mayor, I'm excited to step up and with UFCW explore public option grocery stores to fill those gaps.
This all goes in one direction, and I think you get it. Leftists are jealous, and they're driven by envy and greed. They look at those who work really hard and are well off. To be fair, there are a lot of people who are well off who don't deserve to be, but, you know, it's a question of how the system operates. Some people get easy money, some people inherit money. That's no reason for you to decide you can take it from them, but that's what they're doing. The standard of living these people want, it's based off jealousy. Because if we went back 100 years, if you went back 200 years, these people were kings. And if you're a farmer looking at somebody living in the city, you can be jealous for sure. But the standard of living these people have right now is like they got better dental care than Rockefeller had. But they don't care. They're jealous. These leftists talk about eliminating poverty. No such thing. Poverty is relative. Poor people today have air conditioning, clean running water, hot showers, and refrigerators. How amazing is that? And these people aren't satisfied, so they're going to extract, destroy the system, and burn it all down.
Ayn Rand in The Fountainhead says, civilization is the progress towards the society of privacy. Civilization is the process of setting man free from men. If Marx was around and he would see this quote, he would say, wow, that's very insightful. Marx would really agree with this quote, but he wouldn't agree on his evaluation. He would say, indeed, capitalism is the first time in history where you can go your own way, and this is a problem. So as if he's in a dialogue with Ayn Rand, Marx goes on to say, the right of man to liberty is based not on the association of man with man, which, by the way, is what he wants, but on the separation of man from man. It is the right of this separation, the right of the restricted individual withdrawn into himself. And here we get to the crucial point. The practical application of man's rights to liberty is man's rights to private property. So here comes private property. And here we see what is the real beef, what is the real problem of Marx with capitalism. What is the real problem of Marx with private property? It is that private property signs, seals, and delivers your right to go your own way. This is the problem that Marx has, I claim, with capitalism. Is not the surplus value and the rate of exploitation and the political economy. All this is a rationalization. This is why Marx doesn't like capitalism. He cannot stand the idea that capitalism tells you, go be yourself. It's your life, go live it. So he sums it up. The right of man to private property is the right of self-interest. And guess what? He's right. Marx recognized what Adam Smith and libertarians and conservatives refuse to recognize. Marx sees what every supposed defender of capitalism tries very hard not to see. That capitalism and self-interest go hand in hand.
The right of man to private property is the right of self-interest. That's actually a profound observation. And in the political view of property rights as expressed by Freedom Party, I recall that property rights are considered to be the enabling rights. Without private property rights, no other rights are possible. And when I see what private property owners are paying in property taxes to various governments, it is clear that the right to own property does not exist under any system that is allowed to tax the ownership of such property. And the other very critical thing about private property is that, like freedom, it comes attached to personal responsibility and a need to carry out regular maintenance, which happened to be the very topic discussed on our recent show entitled There's No Time Like the Future.
So to come back to our original question, yes, Marx is to blame. for the blood spilled in his name. Because Marx openly attacked the notion that your life is yours to live for yourself.
Now, I certainly understand what Nikos is getting at when he blames Marx in this philosophical context. But I would look at it from a different context and perspective. Is Marx to blame for the rivers of blood? No, I don't think so. The people who took his ideas seriously and acted upon them are to blame. I kind of liken it to a story our parents used to tell us. If someone tells you to jump off a cliff and you do, whose fault is it? And even if Marx never existed, I'm sure that a lot of other individuals and activists themselves would have come up with their own array of idiotic ideas, usually as a consequence of having their minds programmed by anti-concepts and floating abstractions that have no basis in reality. So either this indicates a very low intelligence capability on the part of a majority of human beings, or we are dealing with a problem of epistemology. And although I think both possibilities are at play, I tend towards the latter. Now, the political rise in the popularity of socialism for the vast majority of people is completely unrelated to the philosophical and ideological nature of socialism. This is why at the opening of today's show, I disputed the notion that there's a rise in the popularity of socialism, because most people still don't know what socialism is, and above all, don't know what capitalism is. The two polarities of left and right, respectively. So where does most of this support for quote-unquote socialism come from? Well, here's part of Glenn Beck's earlier interview with Justin Haskins, where they specifically identified the source.
You know, I saw something in the poll, and this shocked me, because if you would say, where did kids learn about socialism is neat? I would immediately say, teachers, that's not what your poll shows.
No.
What'd you find?
The number one answer was parents. That was the number one answer by far. And that's actually a positive thing. It means if you're watching this show right now and you have kids or grandkids, there is something that you can do to have a real impact on the future of this country. Teach your kids the truth about socialism and communism every chance you get. It makes a big difference.
And here again, while I agree with that advice, the other side of the teaching coin is to teach your kids the truth about capitalism. Simply knowing what's wrong doesn't always mean knowing what's right. And here's another example of this shortcoming I recently found quoted online. Quote, capitalism needs neither propaganda nor apostles. Its achievements speak for themselves. Capitalism delivers the goods, end quote. And believe it or not, that's by Ludwig von Mises, one of the world's most renowned advocates for capitalism. Ludwig von Mises here gives a perfect example of why Rand felt that many of capitalism's advocates were doing more harm than good, at least in this context. Capitalism does indeed require strong, principled advocates, and you can't just get away with saying capitalism delivers the goods, as true as that might be. But when it comes to delivering the truth about capitalism, you can always join us again next week when we will continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, and color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Very well challenged. Well, now we come on to our third round. Our contestant tonight is Karl Marx, and our special prize is this beautiful lounge suite. Now, Karl has elected to answer questions on workers' control of factories, so here we go with question number one. You nervous, Karl? Just a little. Well, never mind, Karl. Have a go. The development of the industrial proletariat is conditioned by what other development?
The development of the industrial bourgeoisie.
Good, yes, it is indeed. Well done, Carl. You're on your way to your lounge suite. Now, Carl, number two. The struggle of class against class is a what struggle?
A political struggle.
Good, yes, it is indeed. Well done, Carl. One final question in that beautiful, non-materialistic lounge suite will be yours. Already, Carl? You're a brave man. Your final question. Who won the English Football Cup in 1949?
The workers controlled means of production. The struggle of the urban proletariat.
No, it was Wolverhampton Wanderers who beat Leicester 3-1. Get out of here.